Welcome to episode 498 of Troubadours and Raconteurs with yours truly, E.W. Conundrum Demure. On this week's episode, we feature another great conversation with artist, visual photography, performance, and his favorite painting, Peter McGough. He talks with us from his studio in Bushwick, Brooklyn. Peter lives in the West Village of New York City, has since the 70s. He once had a partner in art and life named David McDermott. They have since separated, and he now has been working on many projects of his own, namely a memoir from back in 2019. First time we talked was about his memoir, I've Seen the Future and I'm Not Going. It's actually a quote from the former partner I mentioned, David McDermott. We talk with Peter about his art, about society, about human existence. It's a great conversation. Part one. Part two comes next week. We also have an EW essay titled My Man. We share several sunbeams, aka quotes, from the November issue of The Sun magazine, focusing on wealth and poverty. We have an EW poem titled Long Grass. And of course, all of this is imbued, infused with the wonderful energy of several great tunes. It's so nice to be with you. Let's get to it. Episode 498 of Troubadours and Raconteurs.
Please don't tease. If I can hold you, then let me squeeze. My heart goes round and round. My love will tumble me down. You leave me breathless. Well, I shake all over, and you know why. I'm sure it's love, honey, that's no lie. Cause when you call my name, you know I'm burning like wood in flame. You leave me breathless. Ooh, baby, crazy. You're much too much. Honey, I can't love you enough. It's all right to hold me tight, but we need you to love me right. Be shy. This love was meant for you and I. Wind, rain, sleet or snow, I'm gonna be wherever you go. You have left me breathless. Thank you. just know how I'm going to go, Biggie, wherever you go. You leave me. Reckless.
My man. The rice dogs and the Tammany Hall hogs race for the space we call power. The Twin Towers, the Leaning One in Pisa, the Fashionista, cathedrals and oligarchs, knee-deep in the mud swamp of selfish, all convey a dervish sort of wellness. I have a student named Joshua. He recently told me that he is blessed, off the sauce, and is giving the bowl and vape a rest. His tall physical stature and genuine deep eyes were looking into mine, steady and real, helped my distant thoughts to congeal, made me take pause for a moment. How much better I need to do. I want the power too. Not sure which way to go, which type is the purer, more real me. I know which ways are healthy and true in form and essence, but for some reason, or perhaps because of weak reason, the choices every day are somewhat of a struggle. I am spiritually forlorn and befuddled. Such a privilege it is to sit in a warm home on a hilltop with the sun shining through a big picture window, complaining about not being capable enough to control my destructive impulses and be truly free. No worries. There are countless self-help books available for purchase to lift me. Say lovey, my man. Say lovey.
Come on to my house, in my house. I'm gonna give you candy. Come on to my house, in my house. I'm gonna give you apple, plum, and apricot. I do. Come on to my house, come on. Come on to my house, come on. Come on to my house, I'm gonna give you figs and dates and grapes and cakes, eh? Come on to my house, come on. Come on to my house, come on. Come on to my house, I'm gonna give you candy. Come on to my house, I'm gonna give you everything. Come on to my house, I'm gonna give you marriage ring and a pomegranate. Come on to my house, come on. Come on to my house, come on. Come on to my house, I'm gonna give you peach and pear and I love your hair.
Hello?
Hello, Peter McGough, is that you?
This is I.
It is so nice to have you on Troubadours and Rock on Tours again.
Was that what I was talking to before? I'm sorry, I had another interviewer just left. He was late, but here I am.
Yeah, we talked back in February of 2020, right before the pandemic hit in.
Ah, okay.
And we talked for hours, actually.
Was it at WBAI?
No, at Radio Free Brooklyn.
Ah, yes.
And a lot of folks really enjoyed what I shared with them, and I said, and I enjoyed talking with you, so I said, hey, I gotta try to get him on again. So, again, thank you. Thank you for being
on. You're welcome. Thank you for your interest.
Oh, no, it's my pleasure. Peter McGough is a New York City-based artist, visual, photography, performance, arts, and for years, painting is that your favorite?
Yes.
For years, you worked closely with David McDermott.
I did.
And you have been doing your own thing for quite some time now. Your memoir was wonderful. You wrote it back in 2019. That's why we talked back in 2020.
Oh, wow.
I've seen the future, and How are things going since February 2020? How'd you fare during the pandemic?
I loved it. I loved the first 2 weeks of it. I just stayed in bed and watched old movies. I didn't even get out of my pajamas. And then I came to my studio and I just started working feverishly. I had left that relationship. I felt completely free. And I can't stop painting. It was like I had an awakening and I truly became myself. It's kind of kumbaya-ish, but that's what happened. I just had this awakening of like, I'm going to die one day. The planet might not be here for long. And I got to get busy enjoying my life. And that's what I've been doing. And I have made these paintings so beautifully. And I'm completely engaged in my practice. I'm completely absorbed by the work I'm doing. It's become everything for me. It has become an ideal way of living. And I truly enjoy it. I really do. It's something that's so, it has its own effervescence and it has its own world that I continue to live in each painting.
Wow, wonderful. You're fortunate to have that. Any particular focus? Is it abstract?
It's figurative. It's totally figurative and understanding of fantasy. You know, Paul Cadmus, Jared French, the two gay artists from the 30s and the 40s and all, they called their paintings fantasy realism. And that's how I kind of feel with these paintings I'm making now. It's like fantasy realism.
What types of paint are you using? Are you oil?
Oils. I've worked in oils for decades. You know, acrylics, they dry too fast, this or that, and so I don't use acrylics.
And this
I've used washes on paper, but, you know, I like oil paints. I know I'm familiar with it.
And this is in your studio in Bushwick, Brooklyn.
Correct. Yeah, I've been here for like I think 12 years.
Is that where you live as well, or do you?
I live in the West Village, which I lived around the corner when I was 19 years old in the 70s. And so I've watched this decline from artists, writers, poets, LGBT worlds. Marsha P. Johnson, and all these different things, and now it's Barbie and Ken.
It must be more expensive now too.
Well, I have a cheap apartment, so it's lovely, but it's outrageously expensive for what you get, and it's just become a pub crawl for people on weekends. So it's really trying to walk through the mob of partygoers.
In Bushwick, do you prefer Bushwick now?
Bushwick's a dump with a lot of fancy restaurants and expensive rents. But, you know, I'm just kitty corner from a garbage dump. you know, where they wash out the trucks, or, you know, and then you can go get a $20 pizza or something, you know. So it's a dichotomy. It's strange.
Definitely. Yeah. Well, Radio Free Brooklyn's in Bushwick, and, you know, walking around sometimes, you're right, it is a dichotomy. It's sort of...
It's like Hollywood. You can be, there's a gorgeous neighbor and you turn the corner and it's like, you know, a liquor store and a cash bail bond, you know.
Have you been
It's interesting, you know. It's you know, I just took it because I was living on Canal Street and they wanted to up the rent to $6,000 a month. And I was like, for a 5-floor walk up? And then they said, well, you could buy it for $1.5 million. And I was like, for a 5-floor walk up? And I moved out here, and I've been here ever since.
That's great. That's great.
You know, yeah. I went here because it was cheap then.
Now it's getting gentrified, Bushwick, of course.
Oh, yeah, well, you know, gentrification is everywhere.
Yeah.
I mean, I knew that Manhattan would be Millionaire Mile Row. You know, I knew it in the 80s. And now it's just, you know... It's so white toast, you know. It's so bland now. When it was an exciting, you know, AIDS killed all the inhabitants of the West Village, most of them, and then, you know, went all their stores, their restaurants, and everything. It wiped them out, and now it's just white hetero hell. That's what I called it.
White hetero hell.
Yeah, because it's just so bland. It's Cameron and Tiffany and Amber. You know, it's Barbie and Ken. They all look classic. They're blondes with a raincoat belted in the back, straightened hair, untucked dudes, you know, hanging out. You know, God bless them, but, you know, it's bland.
Well, when you were working with David, you two were kind of back into the 19th century.
Yeah, it was, as I was just telling the Times, it was a failed utopia. The failed utopia. And it just all fell apart.
What you and know? David were trying to do, you mean?
Oh, yeah, because of my naivete and his greed for money. And it just fell apart so many times. You know... I bought it all when it was super cheap, and I just lost it all from mismanagement. You know, the bank building in Williamsburg, the up in the Catskill Mountains, this 18th century little paradise that never been modernized. And then I had the house on Avenue C, and it just all went. You know, and I wrote my book, I've Seen the Future, and I'm Not Going, that tells the whole story that came out on Pantheon Random House.
Yeah, it's great. It's great. And great reviews, too.
Fantastic reviews. And then COVID killed all my appearances.
You're going to try to redo it? You're going to try to get it back?
No, maybe a paperback. I asked my editor, Shelley Wainser, I was like, could you send me 20 books? And she goes, I can only find 5. I think it's sold out. So maybe that'll lead to a paperback, but who knows?
Maybe a movie. Who would play you?
I don't know. Many people called me before the pandemic, but I was like, add another zero. You want this for a year, add another zero. But, you know, we'll see. Someone wanted to make a documentary about it, and my ex-partner said there's no way I'll participate with anything of his. So, you know.
Well, he's out. Him. He's in Ireland, right?
He is in Ireland.
And he's sort of a Luddite, more so than you.
Yeah, he lives in his fantasy world. He lives in a world of fantasy. And I don't blame him because the world's horrible. So that was what attracted me, was a fantasy he lived in.
Yeah, and he was a little older, I think, too, right?
6 years.
That's not true. My wife is 9 years younger than me, so sometimes...
Yeah, it's different sometimes. But, you know, the beginning was great, and then when the money came in, it went horrible because he wanted it all. And but there were it looked fantastic, and then on the inside, it was just arguments, and it all fell apart, and the economy crashes came. You know, I thought it'd be a never-ending lemonade fountain, and it wasn't.
Well, you were relatively young, right? How old were you?
I'm 64 now.
Right, but back then?
Oh, I was 23.
Exactly.
24.
What the heck do you know?
On the cover of Art Form, it's a 26-year-old, you know? And, you know, with the best galleries in the world, blah, blah, blah. The horses, the carriages, the antique cars from 1913. And, you know, all that's gone. I was just saying how everything's gone with the wind. He lost all his store. He's angry with, you know, he lost all his storage. He lost every object almost he's ever owned.
It was stolen or just?
No, he couldn't pay the storage bills because I just couldn't raise that much cash for him. And it just went away. You know, the economy goes up and down, and when you don't have a stockpile of money, you suffer when there's a fall in the economy. I've learned my lesson the hard way.
Well, I mean, obviously you understand economics and you experience
now
it. We all do.
But now I do.
Has your vision or your sense of art changed over the years since you're in your 20s? And how so?
I'm a painter. And, you know, the early paintings are very, you know, Grandma Moses-y. And, you know, now I've been working on my own. I mean, I made all the paintings. He hasn't painted with me for 25 years, I guess. And I made all the paintings, signed his name. And after I wrote that book, I thought, well, now I don't have to do anything. Like that again. It was a complete mania, you know.
I don't know what you mean. What do you mean you won't have to do anything like that again after writing the book? What do you mean?
Fight with him, give him all the money so he wouldn't kick in the paintings. You know, he wanted to live in Ireland, and I did not want to live in Ireland. I wanted to be here. Ireland was, you know, it just wasn't for me. I wasn't a drinker, so I didn't have many friends because the social lives are drinking. And when you meet people who are kind of artistic, they love to drink. And I never was a big drinker.
You told me a great story last time about eating some mushrooms. I remember that story.
Oh, yeah, 80s. Well, you know, I was talking to my shrink, and I said, oh, I listened to this man on a podcast, and he's a doctor, and he's a psychiatrist, and they use mushrooms. I want to try. He's like, okay, so how do you want to do it? And I said, I want to get some mushrooms, eat them. And so I ate the mushrooms in my apartment, and then I went to the Washington Square Park, and I thought, oh, this is very nice. And then I went back home, and then the next day I was in a good mood. I said, I think I'm cured. And then the next day I was depressed. So I said, well, that didn't work.
Short term. Oh, sure, you were cured for the short term.
Yeah, I was cured for a day. But, you know, I think that, I don't know. I'm not a big drug person.
That's good. You know, that's good.
I tried them all, and I was like, when is this going to end? You know, it's like, please stop. Just stop. I can't stand it anymore.
Well, it kind of could lose your soul after a while, I find. You know, I mean, I've dabbled with this and that. After a while, you start feeling vapid.
Yeah, it just wasn't for me. And, you know, people like drugs and booze and all that. That's fine, but it's not my way of living. I like to wake up in the morning. I was a sick kid in hospital for half a year. I had all sorts of health issues. And so I hated being sick, and a hangover just reminded me of being in the hospital. So I tried it, you know.
You were raised in Syracuse, New York, went to school there, too. Is that where you studied painting, or did you teach yourself?
No, my mother put me in art school when I was 5 years old, and at the Everson School of Art, which is before the I.M. Pei building. And, you know, she encouraged me. She never told me to get another job. I mean, I couldn't hold a job. And, she just encouraged me, don't forget about your art. So, you know, I was four. So I came to New York when I was 19 because I went to the Fashion Institute. I was either, I got a scholarship there or to the University of Buffalo. And my sister said, don't go to FIT. It's full of homosexuals. And I thought, okay, that's where I'm going. And so I went as an illustrator, and I hated it. So after the first semester, I was like, I'm not going to school. And I took all my tuition money and went to nightclubs and, you know, restaurants. And then I was broke. But, you know.
So you learned there, too, though. It's a different type of education, I suppose. But
oh, yeah. And, you know, I always painted and drew and all this, and I did certain things. And then I started painting with McDermott, who knew every cool person on the downtown scene, like Jean-Michel Basquiat and Glenn O'Brien and different art critics and art writers and people like that. And, you know, Glenn O'Brien and Deborah Harry. So I fell into that world with him. And I was the one who wanted to paint. And so he was an entertainer at the time who did a few paintings to make $200 or something. And he became a painter because of me. He said to me once, well, if you wanted to be a hairdresser, we'd have a 1920s hair salon and do Marcel Wave. But you wanted to be the painter, not me. When I'd say you have to help me paint.
Throw it back at you. It sounds like a normal relationship.
Well, it was, you know, I was showing this drawing I did of two men embracing in a Edison light bulb that I made in the 80s, and I called it No Argument because we always argue.
And this is, you know, personal, but you don't have to answer it. Have you found anybody significant since?
Oh, or? God, yes. Madly in love with someone.
Oh, great. Now, presently.
Eight years.
Congratulations.
Yeah. So it's great. You know, my main objective is to enjoy my life and have the kind of life where I'm happy. And I'm happy when I'm painting. And that's the life I have. You know, I thought I'd quit and be a filmmaker. I made this little short film, you know, that went to film festivals and they flew me there. And then when I made the film, I thought it's just too many people and they're all arguing and the lights fall and this and that. So I went back to painting, you know, because it's a solitary involvement. I love it because it's me living in the painting. You know,
I'm sorry. Go ahead. You were saying you living in the paintings.
No, I asked what?
You said you were living in the paintings. I interrupted you.
Yeah, paintings. I am imbibed in my practice. I'm imbibed. It's everything I want. Because I'm solitary. I'm by myself most of the time.
By choice.
Oh, God, yes. You know, when everybody left with the pandemic and I have a color mixer who comes in every 2 weeks to mix my colors. So, and then I save the palettes in a refrigerator, you know, but.
What does the refrigerator do? How does that work?
It keeps the paints from drying out. A mini freezer.
Oh, great. You know, that's a good trick.
He mixes the colors. I say, here's the blue. I want 5 lighter, 5 darker. Here's the green. Here's the red. Here's the pink. Here's that. Here's that. Here's the skin color. And then he leaves, and I go to town. And it lasts either a week or 2 weeks, and then he comes in again.
You're listening to Troubadours and Rock on Tours with E.W. Conundrum Demure on WFTE Radio, Mount Cobb and Scranton, Pennsylvania. Community radio at its finest.
That's great.
I want to ask you a question because we have like 10 minutes left. I could talk to you for hours. I love talking with you.
Thanks.
No, yeah, you're a pleasure to talk with. I'm wondering in these last 10 minutes, I'd like to shift gears a bit because last time we spoke, I really enjoyed your insights regarding your sense of place in the world, you know, your society and a lot has transpired since the last time we spoke, 2020. Now, Where do you think we are as a society here in the U.S., or if you want to go even larger than that, you know, internationally?
Well, I listen to a lot of things. I don't watch CNN or Fox News or Channel 7 News. I just can't take it. I hate the way they say the news. I don't think they really tell the whole story. I heard the story from who was told by, anyway, I heard the story that was true is that in the election of Joe Biden, Trump called a newspaper owner and a television owner and said, I want you to tell Fox News that 10,000 votes for Biden was a lie and that I'm winning. And he hung up on Trump. And then Jared Kushner called the person and they hung up, and he hung up on him too. He's a media owner, big media owner. And I thought that's real power, because he can destroy people when you own that much media. And the bankers and the people with the money, the trillionaire banks and family, those are the people in power. And you know, I see what's happening in China with facial recognition. You know, I see how they want to get rid of cash and have everything on your phone. And what they do in China, if you're not a good citizen, you can't do anything. Can't get your money out of a bank. You know, they want to get rid of money and they want to have it all on the phone. And they've already done it in China. Facial recognition is everywhere. And I've seen the films, you know, then the COVID protests in China. And my theory in this last few minutes is I'm going to die one day. I will no longer be here physical. I don't know what's after this. I have been close to death, but I didn't die. And what I'm interested in is I watched this documentary, a short one, on people who died and came back. I wasn't interested in what they saw when they died. I saw my uncle, I saw the light, I only saw darkness, and I'm interested in what happened when they came back. And this one woman said, I was in bliss for a few minutes that seemed like hours, and I came back, and now, she said, I can't relate to people. I don't want to talk about what's on social media. I don't want to talk about a TV family of women that's ridiculous. I can't relate to people because I experience this total bliss and everything seems mundane. And I was like, wow, I agree. I think the cell phone zombie world of people walking blocks, looking at their phones. If I look at my phone, it's like a hypnotic state, and then I come out of it, and I'm like, what the fuck was that? And so I think the phones changed everything, and those Apple creators knew it, and they put all of their energy not into a computer but into this phone 14 years ago, and it revolutionized the world. Now people cannot get off their phones. And I see whole families at restaurants are all on their phones, looking at social media, texting, people walking, bumping. I have to watch out now. There's scooters. There's skateboarders. There's moped drivers. There's a delivery people delivering food. There's Uber drivers. There's Lyft drivers. There's, and everyone's staring at their phone.
It's crazy. And I know.
It's insanity. So my attitude is, let me get out of here. I don't want to go. My neighborhood of this quiet West Village is now a pub crawl for Barbie and Ken and Tiffany and Amber. And I'm just like, and they're all on their phone. And I'm like, well, I guess that's what young people do. They go out, but, you know, I'm 64. I had all that. I have so much energy. So I put it into my art and my relationship. And I think the thing is that what's going on in the world is, you know, they have their summits where they all meet about the, you know, the environments and their private jets, which are just complete polluters, and they go to Davos and they all sit there. Nothing changes. Nothing changes. I was listening to this comedian and he was saying it's going to be boiling hot outside. It's going to be flooding outside. So everything is the metaverse. And I read about this man, Snoop Dogg, bought a property on the metaverse, and this man paid $500,000 to be next door to Snoop. And I was like, yeah, it's, and it's all going to be holograms. It's kind of be like Future Shock. All those science fiction writers, they were right.
Alvin Toffler, yeah, I remember that. Future Shock.
You know, Boston, what's his name? They have these robots, and now those dog robots, and then they put a gun on them. It's a weapon. It's not to make people's lives easier. It's a weapon. So
what's,
I'm like,
what's a weapon? The phone?
Those mechanical dogs.
Oh, okay. Yes.
Those robots that can jump from box to box. You put a gun on, it's Terminator. And I'm like, and I watch it, and I'm like, someone's freaking out. I saw this clip of Stephen Colbert, and he's like, you know, the New York Times said there are spaceships. And everyone's acting like everything's normal. It's a joke. And I'm like, I guess, you know, and then all the theories of the world and all this conspiracy, the QAnon people, JFK Jr., it's absolute insanity. And all what's happening in all these countries and how we're giving all this money to Ukraine, we're fighting a war. And the people that are like a Dick Cheney type are making billions of dollars on weapons of mass destruction.
Yeah, that's ironic, isn't it?
They're populated, they want to get rid of people, you know, all those QAnon things. But the world is, it just hit 8 billion. So I think if there's this insanity, if I was in solitary confinement, I'd have to find something to do. So I would just meditate all day because you're in a plastic box with no mattress. And they throw food under the door and you get 1 hour a day outside. So I would just be one of those people on the mountains meditating. And because you're trapped, you're trapped. So I'm on this, I'm a speck on a speck in the middle of the universe, floating in the middle of the universe. We don't even know what's outside our galaxy. We only know that there's galaxy after galaxy after galaxy after galaxy. So we don't even know where we live. So who cares about being miserable? Who cares? Don't do anything. Enjoy your life. Quit your fucking job. Live in a cardboard box and see the world before it's completely destroyed. That's what I think. I like the pain. I love it. It brings so much joy. Not pleasure, but real joy. And I was reading this, the Upanishads, which is the ancient Indian text, and the translation. Yeah. What's that?
Yeah, I know of it.
Yeah, and I found it in the garbage. And I found the Bhagavad Gita. I read them in my 20s, but now I'm reading it. I'm much wiser, and I'm like, there's pleasure, you know, sex, food, whatever. And then there's joy. And I was like, wow, that's outrageous, joy. And I've experienced real joy, nirvanic joy in my life when I was young. And I just wrote an article for Ursula Magazine, about, and it's called How to Find Joy in the Apocalypse. Gee, I'd like to smile too.
I love it.
And it, I have a painting, and it comes out in December. And, you know, I mean, I'm a miserable, depressed, anxiety-ridden person with trauma. And I just think every day I'm like, here's Friday. It's just Friday. It's nothing else but Friday. And tomorrow I have to go out. I have to go to another state. And that's tomorrow. It's not today. And so I keep myself reined in to today. I'm like, don't chomp at the bit. Don't fret tomorrow. Don't look forward. Just stay here. And then, you know, that's how I live my life, because I'm perturbed about the outrageous phone usage. And I have no control over the insanity. nuts. They bump into, they trip. My friend was killed looking at her phone, got hit by a car, killed her.
Oh, boy, sorry to hear that.
Yeah, it's crazy. And so my attitude is, I got to enjoy my life and stay away from bitches. I mean, there's so many bitches out there.
Well, how do you define a bitch?
Somebody, you know, is different. They're all about themselves. And then when they're in a bad mood, they shoot their bad mood onto someone near them and jab them verbally to get them upset so they give up. That's a bitch. You know, self-serving, grasping. I mean, we're all on this rock. You know, and everyone's fighting with each other. We're bombing, you know, they're sending missiles and this and that. We're all ready to push the button and blow it all up. Well, if there's a nuclear bomb coming, put an X on my head because I want to be gone.
Yeah, you want to be at ground zero, definitely.
Yeah, I do not want to live in a nuclear holocaust. And I'm terrified that's how the world's going to end. Or a tsunami that'll wipe out New York, or whatever they predict.
It's wonderful talking to you. I could do it all day. Hopefully we could talk again in the future.
I'm available. You're wonderful to talk to. Thank you so much.
Peter, it's my pleasure. Have a wonderful holiday. Thanksgiving.
A lot to be grateful for. That's my ending. Gratitude. All right. Cheers, everybody.
Cheers to you, too. Ciao.
Bye-bye. Bye.
I have a little song. I'll sing it right. I'll sing it right if it takes once or twice. Oh Lord, oh me, then I shake sugary. Every time, when I say that, I want y'all to say, when I say, oh Lord, oh me, everybody can say, shake sugary. Everything I got is in pawn. Well, I pawn my watch. I pawn my chain. I pawn everything that was in my name. Oh, Lord, oh me, didn't I shake sugary. Everything I got's in. Everything I got's in pawn. I pawn my bond. I pawn my plow. I pawned everything. I even pawned my old cow. Oh Lord, oh me, didn't I shake sugary. Everything I got's in pawn. Everything I got's in pawn. I know something I'm gonna tell. I'm going to heaven in a brown pea shell. Oh Lord, oh me, didn't I shake sugary. Everything I got's in pawn. Everything I got's in pawn. I pawn my chair. I pawn my bed. Ain't got nowhere to lay my head. Oh Lord of me, didn't I shake sugary. Everything I got. Everything I got's in pawn. I pawn my tobacco. I pawn my pipe. I pawned everything that was in my sight. Oh Lord, oh me, didn't I shake sugary. Everything I got's in pawn.
And now some quotes called Sunbeams in the November 2022 issue of The Sun magazine. These quotes focus on poverty and wealth. Americans, like human beings everywhere, believe many things that are obviously untrue. Their most destructive untruth is that it is very easy for any American to make money. They will not acknowledge how, in fact, hard money is to come by, and therefore those who have no money blame and blame and blame themselves. This inward blame has been a treasure for the rich and powerful, who have had to do less for their poor, publicly and privately, than any other ruling class since, say, Napoleonic times. Kurt Vonnegut, from his book Slaughterhouse-Five. One cannot get on well in the world without money. To be in want of it is to pass through life with little credit or pleasure. It is to live out of the world, or to be despised if you come into it. It is to be scrutinized by strangers and neglected by friends. It is to be a thrall to circumstances, an exile in one's own country. That was William Hazlitt. Here's one from Sidney Smith. Poverty is no disgrace to a man, but it is confoundedly inconvenient. This is from John H. Johnson. I've been rich and I've been poor, and I have to admit that rich is better. I'm from the welfare rolls of Chicago, and poverty is always with me. It's what gets me up early in the morning, and it is what keeps me up late at night. This quote is from Muhammad Yunus. Brilliant theorists of economics do not find it worthwhile to spend time discussing issues of poverty and hunger. They believe that these will be resolved when general economic prosperity increases. These economists spend all their talents detailing the processes of development and prosperity. As a result, poverty continues. Here is a quote from Tirso Marino. Spend one day working out in the fields picking oranges or tomatoes at piece rate and see how much money you make at the end of the day. That is, if you can make it until the end of the day. This quote is from Lynn Garthwaite. As a nation, we take great pride in rushing in to rescue people all over the world after natural disasters or horrific despotic regimes. Why is there so little compassion for our own hungry children? Why is a child who goes to school hungry and tired supposed to become superhuman and do amazing things in life? When did we become a nation that turns on its own and looks with suspicion on anyone who needs help? This is some insight from Brené Brown. The truth is, we are the others. Most of us are one paycheck, one divorce, one drug-addicted kid, one mental health diagnosis, one serious illness, one sexual assault, one drinking binge, one night of unprotected sex, or one affair away from being, quote, those people. The ones we don't trust, the ones we pity, the ones we don't let our children play with, the ones bad things happen to, the ones we don't want living next door.
New York, I love you, but you're bringing me down. New York, I love you, but you're bringing me down. Like a rat in a cage, pulling minimum wage. New York. York, I love you, but you're bringing me down. New York, you're safer, and you're wasting my time. Our records all show you were filthy but fine. But they shuttered your stores when you opened the doors to the cops who were bored once they'd run out of crime. New York, you're perfect, oh please don't change a thing. Your mild billionaire mayor's now convinced he's a king. And so the boring collect, I mean all disrespect. In the neighborhood bars I'd once dreamt I would drink. New York, I love you, but you're freaking me out. There's a ton of the twist, but we're fresh out of shout. Like a death in the hall that you hear through your wall. New York, I love you, but you're freaking me out. New York, I love you, but you're bringing me down. I love you, but you're bringing me down. Like a death of the heart. Jesus, where do I start? But you're still the one pool where I'd happily drown.
Magazines on the table, Sister Soul on the radio, Brother Late Autumn Tree Trimmer in the neighbor's front yard, through the living room window, ice on the long grass that should have been cut once more before the frost of winter takes us through another blissful hibernation. Just the same, we could cut it still when warm spring comes again to sprout another rendition.
Standing in the dock at Southampton, trying to get to Holland or France. The man in the Mac says, you've got to go back. You know they didn't.
And there you have it, episode 498 of Troubadours and Raconteurs, with yours truly, E.W. Conundrum Demure. I'd like to thank those folks who made this episode possible. First and foremost, Peter McGough, The Sun Magazine, and these musical artists, Thelonious Monk, Jerry Lee Lewis, Titoro, Elizabeth Cotton, LCD Sound System, The Beatles, Branford Marsalis, and Terrence Blanchard II. And of course, I would like to thank you for listening. Until next time, let's give it a go and do our best with this time. Take care.